This is the view of the rationalist.
In other words, in the clear right of reason, where they don't even believe in witches at all, they laugh aside the evidence of witch trials or put it down just to the fact of torture. You can see this idea in the liberal historians such as Trevor Roper. They blame the excesses of witch hunting on the Roman Catholic inquisitors and torturers. According to this view, the churchmen invented witchcraft as a public phobia so that they could oppress their political enemies. And certainly this happened. And maybe the most graphic portrayal of the way this happened at a certain time is Ken Russell's film, The Devils, if any of you have seen that. But again, this is a view covering the whole of evidence. It's simplistic. It doesn't cover all the variety. Probably far closer to the truth is the third view of Margaret Murray. She believed that witchcraft was an outgrowth of pre-Christian fertility cults, demonstrating many different stages of development, but combining them all within a continuing tradition coming right down to our own day. Related to this is the fourth view of Aldous Huxley and Gerald Hurd, who claim that witchcraft was the continuation of the ancient search for rediscovering a higher consciousness. We were calling yesterday the perennial taste for infinity. But the consciousness made possible through magic in the astral plane, not through drugs or plants or magic mushrooms or sacred mushrooms or whatever. So in the light of this, Aldous Huxley and Hurd were sympathetic to the world of the yogi and the shaman and the witch doctor. And for them, the Shabbat is the joyful festival of escapists, people who wanted to get away from a predominantly penitential medieval age. Other people who like this sort of idea today are people like Theodore Rozsák. And you can see Rozsák's last chapter in The Making of a Counterculture is very close to this idea. This again accounts for a certain amount of the evidence, but doesn't account for the whole. And specifically fails to account for those phenomena which are more than merely parapsychological. But whichever impulses one sees behind medieval witchcraft, what is important is that what has lain dormant for centuries is now again breaking surface. In 1951, the Witch Act was repealed in England and replaced by the Fraudulent Medium Act. And since then, there's just been a mushrooming of witches and covens across Europe and the States. Estimates of the numbers in England range from the hundreds to the tens of thousands. And most of the general involvement is among lower middle-class groups, fairly conservative and generally non-proselytizing. Usually in these sort of groups, the preoccupation with sex and violence is a myth created by the media and has no reality behind it. Their commitment is often studiously serious, even boringly serious. On the other hand, the way our generation has got into these things is far more flamboyant and far more fashionable. And you can see this much better reflected in the news articles, and the interest in the occult bookstores and the reading of Kabbalistic dictionaries, the fascination with the encyclopedias of demonology, the occult books like the sixth and seventh books of Moses, and the various guides, how to do it, six ways to do it in astrology, and all sorts of things like this. I've been amazed the last few years to find how many witch circles and covens are common, even in the most surprising places, right down from junior high school up to the Ivy League colleges. And just since 1965, I think, I've come across now hundreds of male and female witches on many of the English and the American campuses. At first, I used to come across this when the problem of evil came up. And when the problem of evil came up and discussion came up, we used to talk about it. And often I used to turn the thing on them and say, how do you fight evil? Really see their view so they'd appreciate the difference of the answer that Christianity has to the problem of evil. But back about 1965, I first heard the answer, I don't fight it, I'm on the side of evil. And for me, it's a completely new range of answers. And since then, I've had that at least 20 times, I'm sure, in answer in public discussions. People openly supporting some type of witchcraft in view of evil. Between the extremes of black magic and white magic are a whole medley of new witches whose search for a religious experience has brought them to the occult. And many, this is the funny thing, many are dabbling in rites and ritual healings and ceremonies and practices that once, just a few years back, were punishable by death. You know the names of all the celebrated witches of the past and the future. And I won't go into a description of some of these. In fact, this would be a good point for us to have a break. Overlapping with this area, and this is still under Spiritism, is the area of more general Spiritism. In other words, all the phenomena such as voices and visions and levitation, telekinesis, light forms, mediumistic healings, where they're not hoax or merely psychological, and also the area of cultic spiritualism. Now, two factors explain the particular increase in this area. I think the first factor is that there's a difficulty today to discern what's genuine and what's hoax because of the experiential, contentless nature of modern religion. By merely looking inwards or calling on subjective criteria, it's impossible to distinguish false spirituality from true spirituality, the genuine from the counterfeit. And the fact is that religious phenomena such as prophecy, healing, and speaking in tongues can all have one of three sources: psychological, demonic, or divine. So in a day of contentless religious experience, few people tend to ask where the phenomena come from, and experience itself is accepted as self-authenticating. And the result is a perverse confusion in which the counterfeit flourishes alongside the genuine and the spiritistic passes for the spiritual. The second factor why we have so much specifically of the cultic spiritualism is modern man's uncertain view of death and dying. And this is often reflected in the recourse to necromancy, in other words, speaking to the dead. Many bereaved relatives who found themselves inconsolable through the loss of the one they love find that necromancy provides a shortcut solution to this grief, and so it's sharply risen today with the breakdown of the conventions in the way of facing death and dying. During World War I, a famous example of this was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the writer of Sherlock Holmes, who became a spiritualist after losing his son. And in our own time, we have the testimony of Bishop Pike, again, which we'll look at later. The question comes now, what is the mediumistic gift? And how does it become available? In general religious terms, it's obvious that certain individuals have a greater sensitivity towards the spiritual or the mystical. And sometimes this is due to their temperament, sometimes their heredity, or their cultural background. In the same way, but far more acutely, the same is true of mediumistic gifts. And some have this gift as an inherited family sensibility, whether they're aware of it or not, and others can gain it by persistent mental training and practice, and still others have stumbled onto it by opening their minds until they found themselves in turn open to a greater mind. So whichever way it is, so many people today find that they have the basic mediumistic gift. Many in this latter category have stumbled onto it. Many who have taken acid regularly or have practiced yoga and Zen have found that they've opened their minds to a blackness and spiritism, seeing themselves in the long run as mediums, and some have even described themselves later as possessed. This has even happened to people listening to musical groups like the Quintessence. And it has happened very rarely at rock festivals such as Glastonbury. Several times when I've been lecturing recently on the occult, I've been intrigued to find among the questioners those who claim to discover that they had this gift. At least six times in the last month, you know, people have come to our house and have chatted through their problem, and this has been part of it. Many of these people have been unaware of it until some medium had pointed it out, or else they've been led into it by a persistent series of psychic phenomena such as déjà vu and so on. Occasionally, when I asked them to check their family histories, some of them wrote later to tell me they were surprised to find that though their parents had kept this dark from them, their families had a long tradition of mediumistic abilities. One of the English witches who died a while back, Gerald Gardner, wrote that his own witchcraft involvement was through a linear descent like this. He got involved when a cultist approached him and said, "You belong to us in the past. You're of the blood. Come back where you belong." And I know any number of stories like this, of people who stumbled onto this gifts through series of psychic extraordinary things, or through mediums just coming up to them in a crowd with no knowledge of who they are and say, "You have this gift, come and join us." Once I was speaking at Essex University in England, and I saw sitting in the front row a strange-looking girl with an odd expression on her face. The previous night at this series of lectures I'd given, radicals had tried to disrupt the lecture. So seeing this girl, who looked as she was always about to say something and shout out, I spoke and went on giving the lecture, but I also prayed silently to myself that she would cause no trouble. And she remained quiet the whole evening. But as soon as the lecture was over, she ran up to the front, and with a very troubled look, she asked me what spell I'd cast on her to keep her quiet. And then she told me that she was part of a spiritist circle in the south of England, and that one day at their group seance, the spirits had sent to her to travel to Essex, where she'd never been before, and to disrupt a series of lectures beginning that week in the university. The curious sequel was this, that when I arrived back here in Wemo, someone else in the community, it was actually Ginny, and Ginny's far from being a fanciful visionary, she asked me what had happened in those Essex lectures that particular night. Because she said that when she was praying for me that particular morning, she'd seen in a real vision of the lecture hall, as real as waking reality, she'd seen this strange girl, and she even saw the colour of the dress and everything, seen her about to disrupt the meeting. And having prayed for her, she was convinced that nothing had happened. But she wondered if the whole thing was just her imagination or not. And it exactly described the hall and the colour of the dress the girl was wearing, etc. And you often see with these people who have this mediumistic gifts, the presence of a praying Christian, praying in the power of the Holy Spirit, is enough to render the occult inoperable. Kurt Koch tells the story of a German farmer's wife who thought she had a strong rheumatic pain in her hand. And to her surprise, she made the discovery one day that the pain would subside if she wrote whenever the pain came. So whenever the pain became unbearable, she'd take a pen and sit down and begin to write, and the pain would leave her. And soon she developed a real writing compulsion. And eventually she found herself writing way beyond the experience of her own life and far deeper than the intellectual levels of her own mind. Finally, she was writing essentially religious material, and occasionally the name Felix would appear. And after months and months and months, Felix claimed in her writings to be a spirit and said that he wanted to use her as his prophetess. And so over the months and the years, the simple farmer's wife had become a spirit medium. And it was only when someone helped her as a Christian and really freed her from this that both the pain and this compulsion left. For those of our generation who stumble onto the spirit world accidentally, the two most common paths are LSD and misapplied meditation techniques. In the last 3 years, we've seen a growing number who've opened their mind by these means only to find themselves open to heady forces and vibrations beyond their control, until finally they develop mediumistic powers and knowledge rivaling the most practiced of mediums. Sometimes to empty the consciousness of all content is to invite seven devils in from the unconscious. A student who'd been here recently, very heavily involved in the story, and I won't mention the details of it, wrote to me in a letter, "In the beginning we were seduced to yield ourselves to it. But as our mutual familiarity increased, so did our psychological dependence increase. My identity became increasingly the identity of the force I was dealing with. My point of view became its point of view, and I was kept in line by threats of its leaving me if I failed to comply." And this fellow, before he arrived at Libri, had incredible powers of the mind. So he could sit down in a room and make musicians jam to the style of music he wanted, in all sorts of areas. Of far more casual significance than this latter, but reflecting the same fascination with the occult, is the perennial popularity of television programs like Bewitched or Dark Shadows, or the fact that a new magazine like Man, Myth and Magic could sell over 1 million copies its first edition, which is really extraordinary. This involvement should not be ignored as being limited to a general superstitious public or a few young people with insatiable curiosity. A lot of intellectuals have got into this area too. And with some of them, you're not sure if they're really into the occult world or merely the parapsychological world. This is where the quotation I read you earlier from Jaspers come in. Carl Jaspers was reflecting on a time of almost self-induced illness mentally, when he said the personal self had grown porous because of his dimmed consciousness. In other words, he'd reached yesterday the world of insanity, where insanity was very close. And that's where Carl Jaspers wrote. In other words, one of the leading 20th century intellectuals. He writes, "I'd forced untimely access to the source of life, and I recognized too late that murky elements had taken a hand. I got to know them after they already had too much power, and now there was no way back. I now had the world of spirits I'd wanted to see, and the demons came up from the abyss. I have at home a stimulating interview in English with Bergman on a tape. And in this tape, Bergman discusses the genesis and evolution of his philosophy in his films. And Bergman says he's always been fascinated by the function of demons and the voices inside men. But he attempted to make them visible, he says, in The Hour of the Wolf. And he describes the making of The Hour of the Wolf, and he says that he was struggling over the writing of the script in the long northern Swedish night hours. And then he says the time came when he was trying to express these things. Finally, for nights on end, for weeks, he couldn't sleep for demons in the room. And suddenly, I wish I could play the tape to you, he exclaimed, and his voice starts to crack, and Bergman exclaims, "They were there, all of them, and I had difficulty to select them. They would come, all of them, 50 or 60 of them, and I couldn't sleep there for 2 or 3 weeks. I couldn't sleep there because they were there. They wouldn't get out." And here's Bergman, the intellectual, the atheist, one of the best film directors in the world, along with Jaspers, seeing the demons pressing out from the abyss. Again, it's hard to say whether he's really referring to that which he believes is merely the parapsychological, where the mental just breaks down and you have distorted images as the psyche collapses and splits apart, or whether it's the genuine demonic, and the line between the two is very hard to say. It's hardly surprising today that with so many who are coming to know God, out of a background of occult acquaintance first, they really know the reality of the occult. Philosophical arguments about God are unnecessary. That God is no problem. It is who God is that is the crux of their conversion. A particular fellow I was talking about earlier, who had this tremendous power, really believed through this he'd come to know the Lord. And he felt this power was Christian. But it was only when he came to a Christian community that he saw that it was an angel of light and a very far thing from a true spirituality. And he had to renounce it to become a Christian. The highest of all the forms of spiritism is cultic spiritualism, the spiritualist churches. This was founded in 1848 by Margaret and Kate Fox in the States, two sisters who lived in New York State, following a bizarre series of psychic events in their own lives, which itself is interesting. What is not generally known is that both sisters died of alcoholism, but not before both had openly renounced their own spiritualist cult. It's very interesting. Spiritualists don't like to admit this. In 1888, Margaret Fox, in the presence of her sister, said, "I am here tonight as one of the founders of spiritualism to denounce it as absolute falsehood, the most wicked blasphemy the world has ever known." And you wonder if the whole way they got into it, from these psychic states to their involvement and the whole theology they built on it, to their later alcoholism, you wonder if the later alcoholism and bondage wasn't in their case really what the occultists call the devil's compensation. But despite this disavowal, the spiritualist churches are still flourishing today. They tend to scorn the lower forms of spiritism, and certainly both intellectually and ethically they're much higher and more lofty. They use songs and hymns and prayers, even sermons, very, very similar to our Christian worship services. They even use the Bible, although they change the references, like the dead, they cut that out, to living spirits. And they rule out, cut out, all the prohibitions against speaking to the dead. And they view things like the resurrection of Christ not as physical, but merely psychic and spiritual. So Jesus is not so much God come in the flesh as the super medium of all times. It's interesting that hardly distinguishable from this was the later theology of Bishop Pike, whose story dramatically highlights the dilemma of liberal theologians involved with the occult. Pike once said to Schaeffer that when he left Union Seminary, his view of the Bible was no better than a handful of pebbles. In other words, he had nothing left of the scriptures to trust in. So through higher criticism, any rational content as a basis for his faith had been stripped away. And the biblical revelation was no longer normative, a critical control to judge by. Years later, after his son's tragic suicide in New York, Pike was in Cambridge in England, where there occurred a series of curious phenomena. And if any of you read his book, The Other Side, or news articles about it, whole series of phenomena involving postcards, hands on a clock, and the fringes of a secretary's hair. And through these incidents, he felt that his son Jim, who died, was attempting to get in touch with him. And you probably know this led him on to mediums and seances, even conducted publicly on television. And through this, he claimed to be in touch with his son, Jim. And Pike spent the last years of his life re-examining his Christian theology and interpreting Christ's resurrection as a psychic phenomenon. You see, his dilemma was he had no critical norm to judge the phenomena he was experiencing. If the Bible was only a handful of pebbles, what happened was he somersaulted from a critical disbelief of all the supernatural as ridiculous to an uncritical acceptance as all the supernatural as right, simply on the basis of experience. Once he was asked if he had the possibility, if he considered the possibility that he might be experiencing a world of evil spirits. And the questioner went on to relate some stories of spirit worship in China. And Pike replied that the thought had crossed his mind, but that it was too disturbing and he hadn't gone on asking it after the first time it had come to him. The manner of Pike's death was really the final tragedy, lost in the wilderness, both literally, theologically, and metaphorically too. And to compound the tragedy, if you remember the instance of his death, even the mediums failed to provide more than contradictory predictions as to where he was. The third and the last general area is Satanism. Some reject even the talk of this area as mere sensationalism and a love for the lurid. But this is precisely where so much of the counterculture is the most heavily involved. Satanism should not be confused with witchcraft. Witchcraft is almost as old as man. But the history of Satanism begins in France in the 13th century, where the Black Mass was devised as a specific parody of the Roman Catholic Mass. The Black Mass was a requiem mass, not for the dead, but for the living, with the specific purpose of causing harm and propagating evil influence. Instead of the Christians' bread and wine, they used a toad or a turnip or a filthy mixture of urine and feces and consecrated them all in the name of the victim. In the 17th century, you had someone in France like Madame Lavoisin, who was executed as an innovator of this rite in France. And the alleged evidence against her included sacrifice of babies and the blackmail of high court officials. And even Madame de Montespan, the mistress of Louis XIV, is said to have offered herself sexually as a living sacrifice in order to have a way of retaining the king's love. So this was the rise of Satanism. The heyday of this was the 18th century, when there was a riot of orgies and sacrifice, sex and hedonism. Most of it focused around the famous and notorious hellfire clubs located all over Europe, and strangely especially among the aristocratic circles. The most celebrated of these was the infamous club at Medmenham Abbey in England. The so-called monks of this abbey included many aristocrats, several earls, and even the Chancellor of the Exchequer himself. The most notorious of them all was the Eagle Tavern in Dublin, a Satanist club which was used as a cover for several of the aristocratic English as they scandalized the Irish poor. Cannibalism was even supposed to be among their rites. Fortunately, such revolting abandon died out at the end of the 18th century, and we must say largely on account of the evangelical awakening in England and the subsequent profound change of the moral climate and social concern in Britain. Surprisingly, it's in this very area that we're seeing the resurgence today. And interestingly enough, the resurgence parallels the main divisions in modern theology. On the one hand, there are those who are virtually conservatives, i.e. they believe explicitly in the objective reality of the devil. And on the other hand, there are the so-called liberals, those who demythologize the devil and turn the whole religion into a semantic Satanism, a psychological reality with connotations of magic. A good example of the latter, which is notorious in itself and typical of many others who demythologize the devil, is the Church of Satan in San Francisco. In other words, this is the lesser part, which is merely the psychological variety. This was founded by Anton Sander LaVey in April 66 and now claims to have well over 10,000 members. LaVey is a bizarre extrovert who published his Satanic Bible in 1968, but is well known for other things such as keeping a pet lion, for hosting his satanic weddings, and for claiming to have prayed down demons and hate Ashbury. Of course, all these sensational events attracted a huge press who played up with lurid interest such ceremonies as the nude girl on the altar. Some of you may remember his poster a few years back. Join the Satan Church, in the handout like Lord Kitchener's army recruitment poster. And the priest with the balaclava helmet and horns and so on, excuse me, all dressed in black, join the Satan church now on the altar in front of him, the totally nude girl. And these were up all over San Francisco at a time. You can see the church, and it's striking just to look at it. It's set among the attractive whitewashed San Francisco houses, and not difficult to find, because set in such surroundings, it's totally black, with black windows, black curtains, black cats playing on the steps. And as soon as you go inside, there are coffins, skeletons, stuffed dolls, whips, stars of David, and a ghoulish connection of pictures and ritual instruments. LaVey, to his great delight, has been called America's Black Pope. But it's the content of his beliefs, not what he does and says, that's most interesting. Satan, for them, is only the symbol of man's natural, vital, evil forces. I quote, and he said this to me personally, "There is a demon inside man. It must be exorcised, not exorcised. Selfishness is sacred." Someone asked him, "Have you seen the devil?" "Yes," he says, "every time I shave." In other words, there is no devil. The devil is demythologized. The devil is only the sharp forces of man seen in a black way. So the only reality left is in the ritual. LaVey says, "Yesterday's ritual is today's psychodrama." So when the members of his group enter the ritual chamber, they use emotional involvement and symbolic magic words to recreate all the powerful effects of magic without really believing in its genuine reality. The ritual chamber becomes for them what they call an intellectual decompression chamber. LaVey said to me, "We hang our intellects at the door." Of course, I was immediately struck by the closeness of this and much liberal theology in its approach to the creed or the liturgy. You remember the case of the bishop who said, could he say the creed? He said, "Yes, I can still say the creed if you'll allow me to say it as poetry." In other words, the objective content is gone, only the words remain. I asked LaVey about this. He said, "I admit this. The only difference between the liberals and ourselves is that we've been honest about what they've done. They have a whole variety of ceremonial practices, including the rituals of the Black Mass and many of the ancient rituals stretching back to the Knights Templar in Malta, etc. All with interesting modern features to make the psychodrama relevant. For example, the fetishes destroyed are no longer Christian symbols, because he considers these outdated now. Instead, you'll have such a high point and you'll flush marijuana down the toilet, or you'll have a picture of Timothy Leary hung upside down, or have an LSD cube which is just crushed to pieces, something like this, using modern fetishes. So this is the first half of Satanism, the liberal theology of Satan, as it were, those who don't believe in an objective reality of a demonic world, but who use this merely psychologically to recreate psychodramas. The other half of the movement, which has a true belief in Satan as an objective devil, is far more sinister. This will be represented by the various Satan churches and the Church of the Antichrist, now spread through various parts of Europe and the United States. You can find branches of this in Rome, Paris, Geneva, London, New York, and Los Angeles. This is the sort of world suggested in Rosemary's Baby, or described in Dennis Wheatley's novels such as The Satanist, or forecast in the dire predictions of Aldous Huxley in Ape and Essence. I think very few people realize the terror and nausea that's characteristic of these circles. Any satisfaction or amusement that people find from the widely spreading high school Satan circles quickly evaporates on close contact with the thing I'm speaking about now. Often the devotees of these groups will take a ruined or a deserted church, and the part I'm describing to you now I've had described to me by people who've been here. Sometimes an overgrown cemetery. And their ritual begins at 11 at night usually, aiming to finish at 12. And central to the whole ceremony is the altar in the middle with a black cloth and six black candles and a chalice and a crucifix turned upside down. And the altar technically is not what you'd think is the altar. Rather, it's the nude woman lying on the table. And she is the altar, holding in her hands the black candles. And the priest consecrates the host on her stomach. And the black mass that they use is the Roman Catholic Mass, repeated verbatim, word for word. But the word Satan is substituted for Christ. What they do is to go to a Roman Catholic church, to the Mass, and steal the host given out, take it in a handkerchief, and take it back to their own place. And the high point of the ritual comes when the priest has intercourse with the girl on the altar. And often this is an act accompanied by crude sadism. And the evenings usually end with just drunken dancing and drug-taking and a general sex orgy. And often the next day, and this is particularly true recently of California, there have been found skinned cats and beheaded chickens and ritual bags containing drugs, potions, animal bones, and occasionally even human fingers. In other words, this should be a grim reminder that Satanism is very real and is often related to other problems. This is an extremely sober menace, as macabre and repulsive as any of the notorious past which we know. For instance, this sort of Satanism tends to be related to other problems, for example, heroin. A tragically high proportion of those involved in Satan groups, particularly in some of the big cities like London and New York, are also junkies. Secondly, this is related to criminal practices. Blackmail is the vicious means by which the group keeps a tight grip on all its initiates. Third, it's related to violence. Murder is made necessary because of the potential leakage of secret information or incriminating evidence, and it is also justified for sacrifice. Generally in these groups, the victim is only a chicken or a cat, but sometimes it's a human. A child, maybe, or a tramp whom no one knows, or a prostitute who no one cares to report as missing. And one really wonders how many of the grisly unsolved murders in recent years can be traced to Satan groups. Evidence that I know outside the scope of where we are now makes this a very grim probability. The case of Manson's family hardly needs discreet treatment because it's so widely known. But that's typical of the end product of some of these things. On a far less serious level, the high school Vogue and the rock group names and the album titles and the song numbers express the same ideas much more officially, but much more superficially. The Black Sabbath, the Rolling Stones album, their Satanic Majesties, and so on and so on. Speaking of the Satanism, generally there are four ways of becoming involved. The first is by heredity, passed on by families that practice these rituals, and this is rare. Rosemary's Baby has described a situation like that. The second way is what's called devil's subscription. And this is the blood ritual counterpart to Christian baptism. In other words, where one sells one's soul to the devil in a black magical baptism. The third way is occult experiments. With the bookstores full of how-to books, such as The Guide to the Supernatural, many are browsing in these, taking them home and trying them out, and finding themselves slowly out of their depth. And the fourth way is occult transference, the black magical equivalent of the Christian laying on of hands. One man who has the power laying it on to another. So here are the three general areas: superstition, spiritism, and Satanism. As I say, you need to apply those four categories, the hoax, the psychological, the demonic, and the genuine, looking at each of the phenomena as they come across them. Let me finish, though, by saying something of Christianity and the occult. The Christian position on the occult is very clear, immensely practical, and courageous. But this cannot be said for the greater part of liberal theology. And liberal theology is generally embarrassed by the resurgence of the occult and its bold claims for supernatural reality. As such, you must either deny its liberalism or be pushed to even further extremes of rational skepticism. I've often noted that when you're in a group where there's an evident existential reality of demonic power, the people most visibly embarrassed are the liberals, and the ones most visibly shaken are the atheists. It's not just that their naturalistic systems burst at the seam and are unable to explain the evidence. Rather, they really feel their inability to help. And having refused to believe in these things, when it happens and someone's in trouble, they're totally out of their depth, and they have no way to help. They almost have a choice: to deny the phenomena or to join them. And Bishop Pike's career shows what it means to be impaled successively on both horns of the dilemma. And I'm afraid the same comment could be leveled at much of the Christian church which is not liberal today. Even those who are ostensibly orthodox, many of them, the reality has been lost in empty repetitions. As Jesus said in a very different context, their problem is that they know neither the scripture nor the power of God. And then when the crunch comes, they're caught. But what does the Bible have to say about this? I'll break this down just to three general areas. First, the Bible emphatically affirms the reality of the occult world. The Christian description of the universe as abnormal implies not only to the seen world which has fallen, but also to the unseen world, in which there's a devil and evil spirits who in their own rebellion against God have an active influence in the world and affairs of men. Paul wrote, "For our fight is not against human foes, but against cosmic powers, against the authorities and potentates of this dark world, against the superhuman forces of evil in the heavens." Modern spiritism and Satanism, when they are not mere fraud, nor merely psychological factors, actually tap and harness the forces of this occult world. Go back to the account of the temptation in Genesis 3. Eve was promised, "You will be like God, knowing both good and evil." Really, Satanism and black magic are the final antithesis to trust and obedience to God. Because Satanism and black magic offer, one, a knowledge, and two, a power, which are beyond the normal human knowledge and power, and therefore ostensibly on a par with God, but actually under the aegis and authority of the evil one. It's very intriguing that parapsychology recognizes this double nature of magic, as Genesis 3 does. The desire for power, for knowledge rather, and the hunger for power. Parapsychology makes a basic distinction between what they call the psi-gamma phenomena, comes from the Greek word ginosko, to know, i.e. knowledge, and the psi-kappa phenomena from the Greek word kinein, to move, i.e. power, knowledge over or power over. So the Bible clearly affirms the reality of the occult. As occult, the word literally means hidden, or it's hidden and unseen, these forces are unseen but no less real than the world which we call natural because seen. Secondly, it's equally plain that the Bible affirms that the reality of the cult does not give it legitimacy. The Old and the New Testaments are united in rejecting it as real but very wrong. The Old Testament rejects the occult. Well, here we'll go into the Old Testament and the New just for a few minutes. The Old Testament calls for the clarity of community based on the character of God. And in the name of this, it says, steer clear of the occult completely. This is the call of the Old Testament. Israel was to be a national community with a difference because they knew and worshipped a God whose character had a difference. So syncretism and synthesis, either with their neighbors or trading merchants who came through, were strongly forbidden. And one of the aspects that was constantly coming into Israel was the idea of mediums. And you see in the Old Testament that any resort to occult practices, spiritism, fortune-telling, omens, talismans, diviners, magic, is categorically differentiated from the freedom of the open trust of the people of God. And it was denounced as a denial of God and as a sign of social integration and degradation when the nation had left God. Fundamentally, involvement with the occult is an insult to the God in the light of who he is. The Levitical law explicitly says, "Do not resort to them," referring to ghosts and spirits, "for I am the Lord your God." From this standpoint, the occult is an offense against the first commandment, "You shall have no God before me." If God is God, he must be recognized as God and respected as God. So in the Old Testament, the prohibition of magic is not primarily because magic was dangerous, which relates to what we were saying yesterday about drugs. Magic is not primarily a question of the reality of demons and the danger of demons, but rather the question of the character of God. The New Testament develops this further and rejects it even more strongly. The New Testament keynote is this: with the incarnation of Christ, his power over demonic is a keynote of the rearrival of the new kingdom and the establishment of the new order which he's come to bring. The kingdom of God is primarily one of restoration. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor hear good news preached to them. Shackles are removed and the prisoners are released. There's always this excitement in Luke who sees Jesus as the great liberator. But while much of the opposition to this new kingdom of Christ was human, in the form of priests and scribes, Jesus clearly saw that there were occult forces behind the human forces, and he openly unmasked this in the demoniacs. You look at the demon-possessed maniacs in the New Testament. What do they represent? They represent societies fringe failures. Why were they out there in the wilderness? Simply because they had no cure possible. So what they did was to push them outside, along with the lepers and others, and just ban them. They had no way of dealing with them apart from pushing them outside and ostracizing them. Jesus says to people in this context, if it is by the finger of God that I drive out devils, then be sure that the kingdom of God has already come upon you. In other words, by his power over the demonic, wherever it came across him, wherever he went out to it, he showed that the power of his kingdom had arrived. As he looked down towards future generations, Jesus predicted that his followers, if they believed, would perform greater signs even than he had done. And you remember Paul, anticipating the consummation of the kingdom, describes it as a time when all the occult forces will be disarmed by Christ and the earth will seem to be God's. So you have this call in the New Testament. Reject these things and affirm the power of Christ over them, and in this way you demonstrate the arrival of the kingdom. The call to the Christian is twofold. Knowing the reality of these things within the context of the greater reality of God, we can have no time for the shallow, superficial stupidity of much modern occultism where it's hoax. But where it's real, it stands as a challenge to God's character and a challenge to man's freedom. And it's time for the church to demonstrate the greater power and the genuine freedom that are really ours in Christ. As we face the reality of this, other features of biblical teaching should sharpen our critical discernment and clarify the Christian's superior power. Firstly, the Bible teaches the double character of such power as a sign. In other words, the miraculous need not be divine. It can also be demonic. If Moses can demonstrate signs, so can the Egyptian conjurers. In the New Testament, the word sign, or semion, is used of the divine miracles of Christ, also the demonic miracles predicted as a mark of the world's end times, when many counterfeit signs will be performed, which will test the faith of genuine believers. Jesus warned of false messiahs. Paul soberly predicts the coming of a supremely lawless man. John gives his apocalyptic vision of a great beast, of occult forces, and of false prophets. And all these underline the double character of power as a sign. The reality of success is never to be mistaken for legitimacy. In a day of contentless religious experiences, the appeal of spiritual phenomena is far wider than their legitimacy. And if we come across prophecy or healing and speaking in tongues, we must be extremely critical. Interestingly, the word coined for sorcery, predicted in this context in Revelation, is the word pharmakia, from which we get our word pharmacy or drugs. And it's far from fanciful to interpret that this is a prediction of the prevalence of drug-inspired sorcery in the end times. The Apostle John warns in his letter that we must test the spirits to see whether they're truly from God or not. So we mustn't be naive, nor totally skeptical in a day like our own, but be really critically discerning. Such discernment, as is possible in the Christian framework, should lead to a wisdom of balance. The fact that there is genuine power does not mean that all power is genuine. Nor does the fact that there is false power mean that all power is false. The man who most strongly exposes the counterfeit should most warmly appreciate the genuine, and vice versa. And for every counterfeit phenomenon under occult power, there is also a genuine counterpart under the Holy Spirit. Biblical prophecy often included extrasensory perception, ESP, made possible directly by the Holy Spirit, which is what we call prophecy, whether it was rational or ecstatic. Biblical healing or exorcism is extrasensory influence made possible in the power of the Spirit. And angels in the scriptures are spiritual beings, unseen and supernatural, but just as real as the occult forces of evil. Now, I haven't time here to go into the related questions of diagnosis and counseling, and these are too detailed and complex for this more general discussion. But with no hesitation, I would just say this. In Jesus Christ can be found complete liberation from any occult bondage. Christ does liberate from these things. And when he does, the word liberation no longer seems empty religious rhetoric, because it really can lead to a dynamic new freedom of life. And I don't say this last sentence lightly. but on the basis of experience of people we've known here personally, many of them. Whether the bondage involved is a dark suicidal depression, or severe alcoholic addiction, or very strange features like the inability to float in water, which I've come across, liberation in the name of Christ has brought unmistakable, decisive freedom for change and growth and the solution to their other problems. Paul evoked the image of the Roman conqueror's triumph when he wrote of Christ. On that cross, he disarmed the cosmic powers and authorities and made a public spectacle of them and led them as captives in his triumphal procession. And those of us who are Christians must really demonstrate that the same power of Christ is active and available today when so many need this power. So if we can see the encircling eyes threateningly pressing in around us as the fires of Christian culture burn low, we can surely feel the tragedy of a generation which has set out on a road of shining idealism but lies so far from its destination now. The counterculture is really in the order of a myth, and the pathway to the present situation is debris strewn with broken and abandoned ideals. The occult, as the occult matures from a fad into a phenomena, it too is spiraling downwards towards the dark and dangerous and depressing. Combining with acid and rock music, a part of the occult is withdrawing into itself, finding its only hope in an esoteric and apocalyptic rapture for the spaced-out elite. They're even counterfeiting Christian eschatology and hopes for the last times. And much of the movement has become heavy with spiritual vibrations. Certain people describe the Glastonbury Rock Festival as a satanic Pentecost. And many are preparing for the time when a starship or some such thing will rescue the only elite that's left. You remember that thing that Paul Kantner put out, the Jefferson Airplane, with his little ad, "People needed now. Earth getting too thick. Move on out to the cool and dark. Embarkation date, Millennium 4, approximately 1989, Starship Foundation." One's not sure whether some of them are taking it seriously or just spoofing, or whether the whole thing's just rather sick. History will cast its own verdict. But what you can see without any doubts is that where we are now, at the end of the spiral of the occult, we're a far cry from the early Beats, or the Freedom Riders, or the euphoria of the early people who got into the psychedelics. Seen in our mind's eye, our generation has come full circle. And you can visualize our generation as caught in a gigantic, unlit, secular enclosure. Around the dark, and around the frontiers, pacing the centuries, the philosophers, the poets, the artists, the thinkers, grappling with a great unknown beyond, and wrestling with the absurdities within the circle, many of them counting their own lives as dice in the last throw of the game to find meaning. Pressing out after them are the young and the brave and the committed and the idealistic. Some of them fated to take their own place in the precarious, lonely frontier. Most of them fated just to fall back, frustrated and bewildered. Back in the middle, anyway, live the great majority, self-sufficient and self-contained, afraid to follow in the questioning line of their fears, and unwilling to pursue the hard discipline of any alternative. I think as you come to the occult and see where it's led, you really see the point where our generation has reached the terminus of its searches. Maybe at this point what we'll see is a new cycle of optimism begin again. And as I said elsewhere, I think that this is what will happen if McGovern is elected president or some other optimistic factors come into the situation. It'll give them new hope. And romantically, the whole spiral will begin over again. Idealism, romanticism, aiming for the right goals, but no basis, frustration, despair, and finally, the terminus where we are again. So personally, I think the occult is the end of the line for the counterculture. So unless there's a new spiral, which will undoubtedly start in some direction or another, what we'll just see is an increasing trend towards some of the unwelcome possibilities that are ahead of us. As Rorschach said, if the counterculture fails, we've nothing in store for us except what Huxley and Orwell forecast in Brave New World. Of course, as Christians, we would say, if the counterculture fails, and it has failed, we wouldn't put any hopes in that. We would put our hopes in the possibility of an alternative through a Reformation revival.